You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Lan Yen,
the feisty heroine romance collection of short stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award-winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution. Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Lan Yen on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new book. It's called The House of Yen, A Family at the Heart of a Century in Chinese History. Lan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Hank, to invite me to join you for your show.
I am super excited to have you. The book is amazing. I learned so much from it, and I'm excited to talk with you today. But we begin each show always with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or a storyteller?
Well, it's back more than 20 years ago. When I lived in France at that time, from 1991 to the end of 90s. At that time, whenever my friends in France ask me about my family, my experience during the Cultural Revolution, I could tell how astonished they were when I told them what my family and I had experienced and survived. So I realized that not only foreign friends, but also the younger generation Chinese had very little concept of what happened in China during that period, Cultural Revolution, or period which preceded. So I think, I decided to write, as you know, write down my story, my family story, as witness of times we had lived through. And one day, this is 5 years ago, very concretely, I came back to France in Paris. I met an old friend of mine. So she said, Lan, what is your personal project? I said, oh, when I retire, I am thinking to writing my story and the story of my family. So she said, oh, why now? So she said, you should not wait until retirement. You should start right now. So 5 years ago. I said, oh, she was right. Then she said, Lan, you prepare a table of contents of your story. I introduce you my editor, my publisher. So this is happened. Next day, I went to see her editor. She is a great lady, like a lot of experience. And I told her my story. She said, Lan, let's sign the contract. So I was I was a little bit scared. I said, oh, it was my first time. I never wrote a book. Indeed, I wrote my thesis, doctor thesis. So it's not the same thing. But she said, it's a wonderful story. So you have to get prepared. Let's do it now. So this is the story of writing a book. So I used 2 years to write my book. In 2017, my book was published in French in France. Yeah. Wow. And then, so this year, so just 1 month ago, So my book was translated into English by HarperCollins. I'm so excited because as a newborn, I did some speeches in New York and in Boston. So I thought it's great because I have this English version. Much more people can read it, the story. And right. Yeah.
Well, I'm so thankful that that friend of yours encouraged you to write down your story because, you know, and this is why it's so important when we're dealing with a country like communist China, where we use terms like cultural revolution, which sounds it sounds so benign, you know, like but it really tried to erase thousands of years of Chinese history and tradition, and replace it with this, new communist way of thinking, and it's because of people like you who write down those stories that history is preserved.
Yeah, well, I agree with you because, you know, more I think, more I believe that in fact the history can be very abstract without details. So my story is one of the details of China modern history. So because when I published my book in French, I got a lot of emails, letters from the French readers. So they told me, Lan, we learned, thank you very much for your book. We learned Chinese history at school, through books, but your family story let us understand the suffering of Chinese people and upheavals of the country. So I think you are totally right. It's true. So I think it's like a witness and a true story to bring the history alive, right?
Right, right. The book is The House of Yan. Tell us a little bit, or The House of Yan. Tell us a little bit about your family in particular, and what is it that you're trying to preserve and bring about to the rest of us in your book?
Yeah, yes. So this book, in fact, my book is telling about three generations of my family through almost 100-year China modern history. So I start from my grandfather, Yan Baohang, who was born in Liaoning province and from a poor peasant's family. But he managed to go to the city for study and then got a scholarship, went to Edinburgh University during 1920s. But when Japanese occupied his hometown in Manchuria in 1931, he participated actively in anti-Japanese movement with his friends and joined nationalist leader Chiang Kai-shek and his wife, Madame Jiang. Later in Nanjing, during 1937, he met Zhou Enlai, who pursued him, convinced him to join Communist Party to fight against the Japanese. Then my grandfather went on to become a secret agent for Zhou Enlai for Communist Party during the Second World War, and famously obtained a lot of information. One of the important information he got is about Germany was planning to attack the Soviet Union, named Operation Barbarossa. My father, my grandfather's youngest son, Yan Mingfu, was a diplomat, studied Russian at age of 16, and became Mao Zedong's personal Russian-Chinese interpreter during 1950s and 1960s. Today, he's the only living witness to Sino-Soviet relationship from honeymoon to the Cold War, as he was involved in all the talks and discussions between Mao and Chinese leader, top leaders, and Soviet leadership during that period, 1960s, 50s, until the Cultural Revolution. In fact, my childhood was a very happy one until my family life, like that of millions of Chinese families, were turned upside down by this Cultural Revolution, which began in 1966, last 10 years. It was a nightmare for whole China. So my grandfather was put into jail, and 7 months later, he died. My family was officially notified 10 years later of the death of my grandfather. My father was imprisoned, also detained in a single cell for 7 years and a half without charge and trial. He was suspected as a Soviet spy because he's supposed to translate, you know, Chinese leaders' conversation, secret conversation with Soviet Union and with leaders. So my mother, who was diplomat, and was sent to a re-education camp for more than 6 years. So I was alone in Beijing at 10 years old for 1 year and a half as an orphan. Before I going to join my mother in the countryside at her re-education camp. Without, at that time, with my mom, so we were in the countryside without knowing whether my father was died or alive. But my mother always told me to keep up hope for change. This episode was, for 10 years, disaster for China, during which millions of people died or persecuted. So it's a true nightmare for me, for my family, and for entire country, I said. So this is the reason why I want to tell the story as a witness to never forget this darkness period of China, and to avoid that, to draw the lesson from the history, and to avoid the repetition of this nightmare.
Right. For
China.
For those that are not familiar with the recent history of China, could you explain to us exactly what the Cultural Revolution was?
Yeah. So, in fact, the Cultural Revolution was launched by Mao Zedong, started, as I said, 10 years, started in 1966. Mao Zedong, just 1 or 2 years before that period, started to get some suspect that Chinese top leaders at that time, Liu Shaoqi was the chairman of China, and Deng Xiaoping, we know all these names, was also top leader of China. Mao Zedong suspected them to have ambition to replace him. So he said, okay, I need to launch a revolution or the movement, mass movement, and to against this, all the anti-revolutionary people, all the revisionists, all the federalists around us. So the target was, of course, the top Chinese leaders, as he thought his opposition. So the Cultural Revolution started as a struggle of power, you see. So long this Cultural Revolution, so for me and for our lot of friends in China, we said it's against culture, right? This revolution, so-called revolution, was against culture because it's destroyed Chinese traditional culture, traditional value, and the old good tradition in China. So Mao launched this struggle. He said, we need to mobilize the people and the mass So to do the revolution, that means at every level of the whole country, the people fight each other, try to find the suspect, try to accuse other people as anti-revolutionary, etc. It's totally a mess. So this is the last 10 years, you see. It was totally nightmare. Millions of people died, and millions of people were persecuted. A lot of intellectuals were sent to either on prison or to the re-education camps, to the countryside, including the young people. Mao said, okay, the young people, you need to receive the re-education from peasants. In fact, so all the schools were closed the door. So we didn't study. We didn't even have right to go to the university. So the young people work in the countryside, and the only people who could go to university at during the Cultural Revolution or after, you know, I mean, during the first 3 years, the university almost closed door, and maybe started from 70s, university reopened, but the only soldiers, peasants, and workers who were, you know, who could be recommended to go to university, but now study the true, you know, knowledge about the science, about philosophy, is to study, you know, politics. So it's really the ridiculous period for Chinese, in Chinese history.
The re-education camps, that sounds awful. It brings this connotation that we don't want you to think for yourself. Therefore, we're going to it makes you think of brainwashing. In the beginning, you tell the story of your family through your eyes, through your perspective, and it's very different to read some political paper on China and during this time period. It's a very different thing to hear your personal story and how this affected your family. When you're recalling, like when your mother was in re-education camp, and then when you were sent to a re-education camp, how difficult was that to remember and to write down all the details?
Yeah, so this was, yes, so it was very difficult. I think it's a very tough period for, in particular for my mother, because she was accused to be, the family, the relative of anti-revolutionary. That means my grandfather, her father-in-law, was anti-revolutionary, put in jail, and her husband, my father, was put in jail, suspected as also anti-revolutionary, Soviet spy, etc. So she was innocent, but she was the family. So you have the bad labor, the black family. And so she, for a moment, she was asked to consider divorce my father. Because if he, in the Cultural Revolution, it became a common, I very sad to say, a common practice. Because if the wife is innocent, if you divorced your husband, or vice versa, husband is innocent, your wife got some problem, you know, so-called crime, etc. So if you divorced and you can became clean, right? So my mother, they said, if you divorced your husband, you can came back from a re-education camp to Beijing and work again. So my mother refused that. She believed that my father was innocent, and she wanted to wait until the day she got a clear conclusion after investigation. So she stayed very firm. She was for me, when I was young, I saw her as such a courage woman, a lot of resilience and a lot of courage, very tough character. So she was 7 years. So I joined her in 1969 to Henan province. So she was there during the daytime. She worked hard work, hard physical work to make bricks. All her team are males or men. She was the only woman. It's demanding a lot of physics labor work, very tough. But during the evening, she was the target of a criticism meeting, and she forced to confess what or make a self-criticism. So she always refused to do so. So it's very, very tough for her physically and mentally, but only a good moment for us, for my mom and with me, is the weekend. So I went to join her. So all the children of this re-education school were put together. We lived in central of the village, the big town, and we could still go to school during the whole week. So that means it's a sort of a boarding school. So we went there, we sleep there and doing together. And then during the weekday, so we went to the school, local school with the parents' children. So in this sense, I thought, oh, I was lucky. You see, in Beijing, the school, all the school, almost they closed the door. The student and the children and the teachers were doing revolution. So they didn't teach anything. So, but in the countryside, it seems that the revolution didn't come to affect the study. So we go to local countryside school. We can still learn the things. So, but only during one day, the Sunday, we were allowed to see our parents in different villages in this re-education schools. So I went every Saturday evening, so walk for 1,000 kilometers to see my mom. And so the Sunday, sometimes she got a free day, free time. So she always took me on a bike tour, go to in the countryside. And she told me, I still remember, she told me the classic stories, Chinese classics, European classics, you know, French literature, and the Chinese classic poems, literature. So it was, she created a sort of shutter, a sort of a bubble of for me to escape this hardship of our life there. So I still remember how much I benefit from this moment with my mom.
Right. In spite of all of the turmoil that was going on. That's incredible.
Yeah, exactly. So she, I think, so this from there, I learned how to draw your strengths from the suffering, from the hard, from difficult moment.
What is it like in China now? You know, they are obviously a manufacturing powerhouse, and, you know, this big, robust economy. We don't hear much about the Cultural Revolution anymore. What is modern life in China like, and how do they look at their history over this last 100 years?
Yeah, this is a good question. Nowadays, so people, well, last year it was 40 years. Well, I mean, I should say 50 years anniversary of starting of Cultural Revolution, you see. And I'm sorry. So this is not last year. So it was, well, back a few years ago, because it started 66. And so anyway, so in China, it's interesting. When I ask the young people today whether or not they know the Cultural Revolution in China modern history, most of them didn't know well, didn't know so well. I was surprised to see, because first of all, I was told in the school education materials, they're not so much. Well, they have certainly one, well, few pages. They talk about Cultural Revolution, but not so many details and analysis, etc. So the young people didn't know that story. And today, so when I ask them, so whether or not their parents or their grandparents told them this story, they said no. You know, Hank, in China, they're a tradition. Well, I mean, the parents don't, most of parents don't like to tell their suffering and their painful experience to their children. They prefer to keep for themselves. They always encourage their children to look forward, to get a better life, to study hard, to change their life, right? So this also, and also, you know, so this is the situation today. The people, the young people try to, you know, look forward, study hard, change their life and get a better life. And so instead of a look back of our history, but for me, I think it's always important to let younger generation to know what happened in China and what happened and the reason why. So to try to learn and to understand and draw the lessons, right? So I one day I saw the famous sentence, well, a sentence said by President Theodore Roosevelt. He said, the more you know about the past, the better prepared you are for the future. So while I think the more you know about Chinese history, the better you understand China today, right? So this is so important to let people, let Chinese younger generation to know what happened in China. So this is why I want to write this book.
Absolutely. Well, and not only does it help us to see the future through the past, but it gives us, like I said earlier, it's very different to read an academic paper on the history. It's a very different thing to see this through your eyes and your mother's eyes. Putting a human story on it really helps us to understand the realities of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're totally right.
Yeah. So what do you hope people take from this book? This obviously is a very personal book to you. It's telling your family story, but it's doing so much more than that. What are your hopes for this book when people buy it and read it? What do you hope they're left with?
I think this, I hope through my story, the people can learn about, just like you mentioned, about the history of modern China through the concrete story. Secondly, I think my book is about to keep optimism and hope. I just share a story with you. So after publish my book in 2017, 2 years ago, so 3 years ago, so a few months later, I got an email in Beijing and in Paris. So they said, Lan, in May 2018, we gave your book a award. So I was honored to be awarded by a prize named Simone Weil. This prize was established in Memoir of an Exceptional Woman, Simone Weil, who survived the Nazi concentration camps and went on to do so much for women's rights in France. She stands as a symbol of resilience and dignity in face of unspeakable horror. So this happened. So the day I get this award was the 25th May. It's my mother's actual birthday. Of course, she had passed away 3 years previously. But this ceremony, this prize, everything about them was a vindication of what she believed. So I said during the ceremony, when I accept the award, I said, so I wish to share with you, with all the my friends, what passed on me by my mother, a message of hope and belief in future. This is what my book, Only Ambition. I have not forgot the humiliations or the loss that I suffered as a child, but it's no hate in the adult that I became. The hate stands in the way of human accomplishment. It is in suffering that we learn to draw on our resources and find within ourselves the strength to change our destiny. So this is my message from my book.
I love it. I love it. The book is called The House of Yin, A Family at the Heart of a Century in Chinese History. This is a must-have for your bookshelf, especially going into an election year or when we really need to be thinking about the past to think about our future. Lon, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show. If people are just learning about you, is there a place they can connect with you online, a website or anything?
Website, well, it's WhatsApp. Oh, WeChat in Chinese. they can contact me through you.
Great.
You have all my
absolutely emails, absolutely right? We'll put links to the book in the show notes of this episode where everyone can buy their copy.
And thank you so much.
Hey, thank you so much. Yeah. Lon,
and have a waiter bring him a martini, which he would down before he hit the
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity. Structure of story and things like that, but I really enjoyed the creative process.
The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app?
He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
he asked. You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to
it. Some things you write now, do they differ in the writing process from
plants? Looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?
He asked the mysterious caller. You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire? The caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
If you're so close, why can't I see you? He asked.
He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow paddy.